Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Tuesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Good, bad, and crazy martinis for you today, as usual. We start with the good, and it comes as the latest evidence that the Democrats just don't have a very enthusiastic base right now for the midterm elections. And with only 3 weeks to go, there's not a lot of time for that to change. The latest evidence coming from today's Washington Times: labor unions, long a rich source of ground troops for National Democrats' Election Day victories, are less enthusiastic this year, according to some movement leaders who say they are more focused on state-level races and feel left behind by the party on key issues such as Obamacare. While public sector unions remain almost universally supportive of congressional Democrats, more traditional labor unions in key industries and key states express frustration with the party or say they haven't been given a reason to get as deeply involved in the midterm elections. AFL-CIO political director Michael Podhorzer says the prospect of a Republican-controlled Senate isn't as potent a motivating factor for voters as trying to draw a contrast between the parties. Terry O'Sullivan, general president for the Labor's International Union of North America, is very upset with the president because they're big backers of the Keystone Pipeline, as are other unions, Jim. So, I mean, if the ground forces are either unmotivated or much smaller in numbers, that's a big deal.
Yeah, I'm almost a little bit surprised by it. And you almost, you hear that, you wonder if this is some sort of like low effort to lull us into a false sense of security. Because from where they sit, with the exception of the Keystone Pipeline, Democrats are going to be warmer and fuzzier towards them than Republicans are. And that's because they've kind of been symbiotic, you know, and in fact, some would argue that the modern Democratic Party is a wholly owned subsidiary of professional big labor. So the idea that that they're kind of meh on this election is kind of surprising. But the flip side of that is that if indeed they're recognizing that the green agenda of the Democrats is interfering with their desire for good paying jobs and big projects like the Keystone Pipeline for their members, well, then, guys, staying home may not be enough. You know, I mean, at that point, maybe it's time to reevaluate a lot of your viewpoints. So it's pleasant news to see. I wouldn't count on it if I'm a Republican, but rather intriguing to see, the labor unions. Maybe what it is kind of a broad-based lethargy in recognizing that the last 2 years of the Obama presidency are going to be are not likely to be a sterling success and good times for anybody.
I think you touched on something really important, though, Jim. I think there is a natural friction between two of the major wings of the Democratic Party, between the environmental movement, which obviously is not very favorable towards manufacturing, and organized labor, which obviously is. And which one's gotten more airtime and attention from this administration? Certainly in the second term, it's pretty clear it's been the green agenda. We just saw a new story from the Pentagon where Chuck Hagel is out at some conference in Peru telling people they got to get on the climate change issue, never mind the fact that we're not having very much effect against ISIS or combating Ebola or anything else. So,
yeah, we're about full of crises right now, Secretary, you know.
Yeah. All right. On to the bad martini. And speaking of Ebola, we just talked yesterday about how things were not looking good when all the precautions in the world didn't stop a nurse treating the Ebola patient in Dallas, didn't stop her from getting Ebola. And now she's under very close watch as well in stable condition. We hope she pulls through. She's getting a transfusion from one of the doctors that survived Ebola. But now we've got, as Jim points out in the Morning Jolt, shifting language from the CDC. We have to rethink the way we address Ebola infection control because even a single infection is unacceptable. You say this is from Thomas Frieden, the director of the CDC, did not detail precisely how the extensive government-issued safety protocols in place at many facilities might need to change or in what ways hospitals need to ramp up training for frontline doctors or nurses. So there's this kind of vague admission that what they said was not true, but they don't want to alarm people, and maybe they're not even sure what will stop transmission, Jim, but either way, not very encouraging.
You don't want to unduly alarm people, but it certainly seems unnerving that, you know, 9 days ago, this guy is saying, we're going to stop it in its tracks. And then a couple days later, well, we clearly had some sort of protocol breach, and we've got 70-some people at the hospital who are under observation who don't have it, but they're being observed because of exposure, because clearly somehow Ebola got from this patient who has passed away in Dallas to one of his nurses, and nobody really knows precisely how it got there. They're speculating about when she was taking off the suit, did some of it get on, you know. It's just an unnerving tone, and then you kind of put out this, you know, As I mentioned in the morning jolt today, Greg, that you know, the good news is we're now doing advanced screening or more screening at six international airports. And great news, Greg, this will take care of 94% of the people coming from this region. That makes me feel about 94% confident, doesn't it? I mean, because what about that other 6%? You know, it's 9 people a day. Oh, okay, that's 45 people a week. That's 180 people a month. And as we all see, we already know somebody came here, you know, and that gentleman, Mr. Duncan from Dallas, came here with Ebola. It just kind of seems like this is not a terribly reassuring, every time the goalposts move a little bit. It's also unsurprising that just poll came out shortly before it came on the air, that quite a few folks, I believe it's a solid majority, 67% of people overall, 60% of Democrats, 68% of independents, 76% of Republicans, would support restricting entry to the United States from countries struggling with Ebola. And 91% want to see stricter screening procedures at U.S. airports. You know, the public is not wavering in its assessment here. They're very clear. You know, stop these flights. And it doesn't appear the administration wants to consider this move. I don't know whether they keep insisting, well, you block flights coming out. It gets harder to get aid workers to get in. I suppose I understand that. But at the same time, I don't understand why we can't just charter flights and you know, screen them everybody ourselves. It's just kind of a strange lack of response there. But this was right at the intersection of our bad martini and our crazy martini, Greg. Because, you know, quarantines are really important, right, Greg?
That's what we hear.
Really important. We hear this from people like, say, NBC's chief medical correspondent, Nancy Snyderman. except she, because she was over in Africa doing stories on this, she herself was exposed to the cameraman got Ebola. So she was under quarantine. And she violated that quarantine. She went, and I sounds like I'm making this up, Greg, wearing sunglasses as she picked up a takeout order at her favorite soup restaurant in New Jersey. Greg, why could she not find a place that would deliver?
I don't know.
Was it that unthinkable? Leave the food on the stoop. I'll get it out in a little while. Just weird, you know. And she says, well, as a health professional, I know that I have no symptoms and pose no risk to the public. The CDC doesn't agree, you know. So anyway, so we're if we all die in a terrible apocalypse, maybe it's Dr. Nancy Snyder's fault.
It could be. Came up in a Senate debate last night in Virginia, too. Mark Warner and Ed Gillespie. And you put that in the jolt. And it's interesting. You get that typical Mark Warner language of where you think he's making a really forceful statement saying it may be time to consider restrictions on flights from West Africa.
Yeah.
Ed Gillespie saying no.
That time. That was like a couple of days ago. Okay, now it's do something.
And Gillespie's language was much, much stronger on that. So anyway, on to from 2014 to 2016. And Hillary Clinton, one of the issues that she, of course, had to deal with when her book came out earlier this year was the fact that she was dead broke. And then it found out she was making huge speaking fees. And it turns out that hasn't stopped. Only Hillary Clinton can take – this is Jim from the the campaign spot today – only Hillary Clinton could take a $225,000 speaking fee from a public university and then in the speech lament how high the cost of higher education is. Higher education shouldn't be a privilege for those able to afford it, she said. Jim, for some reason, it seems like it's always UNLV that's involved in this whole thing with her. They must really, really like her. But apparently, tone deafness doesn't go away just because the book's not on the shelf anymore.
I'm just kind of observing, you know, she's got herself in an embarrassing situation. A lot of us kind of scoff at these giant speaking fees she gets to begin with, to get them from a university and then a public university. Like there was a trouble with it. It was a university up in Connecticut, and their attitude was, well, you know, this was a private grant that was designed just to bring speakers to campus, and that's what we used it for. But if you're going to do it from a public university, which, oh, by the way, just announced tuition hikes, it's going to look pretty badly for you. So there's one or two things you could do. You could address it head on, and Hillary could talk about how unfortunate it is. She could, you know, say, I don't want the fee. You know, here's where I think we should do. Instead, she kind of laments how high and expensive tuition is without ever acknowledging that, oh, by the way, and I'm taking $225,000 from this university that, you know, I think it's very tough to argue that that she needs. So, you know, the fact that she doesn't sense any connection between the high cost of tuition and her taking this six-figure fee, pretty useful indicator of how disconnected she is and how there are special rules for her. And she, who has in the past denounced the greed of rich people, seems no problem taking this kind of money from a public university.
Jim, it was an excellent post on Campaign Spot, and I encourage folks to take a look at it. However, don't do it if you've just eaten, because there is a picture at the end of it featuring Hillary Clinton and Harry Reid in Siegfried and Roy gear. And seeing Harry Reid in the jumpsuit with the shirt open, a little bit unappetizing, to say the least.
You know, I'm going to take a slight disagree because I think that was done by America Rising, the opposition research group. And I got to tell you, Greg, I think it's a little unfair because Siegfried and Roy, they put on a show for the money you pay. I mean, you know, white tigers and all that kind of stuff. You know, Hillary, Harry Reid, what do they give you? You know, maybe an earmark?
If you kick in, yes.
Exactly. So,
very good. Jim, have a good day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And be sure to join us Wednesday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.